Hello there, this is John Heindorf with another one of our longer form interviews with people who are at the very heart of the sport that we all love. We call them Tyler's Long Ones after Graham Tyler, who started this tradition a few years ago. Graham hasn't been able to make the trip over to Florida, so I'm standing in. I'm afraid I am nowhere near his twinkliness or his expertise, but I hope that our subject for today's Tyler's Long One, Peter Barron, will let me off that one. Peter, it's been a while since you and I have spoken properly, but it's got to be at least 10 or 11 years since we first met. And you were driving in those days. Take us back to those early days of the American Le Mans series. And where did Peter Barron come from in those days before, in fact, even before you and I first met?
Oh, let's see. From the driving standpoint, I had one foot in the business world and one foot in the driving world. And the biggest thing was, I wanted to make sure I had some stability, and I had witnessed a lot of my friends that devote themselves, who were fabulous drivers, to try and make it. And, they gave it their 100% with that, and didn't make it, and they had all the talent to make it. So I decided to keep my foot in both worlds. But
so did you come up through national racing, through karting, or through track days, or what?
Yeah, so that came up. I came up through Sports 2000. Was basically the first thing that I came up through, and then went over here. They had the Toyota Atlantic Series. And it was in my mid-20s doing that. And at 26, I had some success. In that year, Patrick Carpentier won the championship. Richie Hearn was right there. And, both those guys made it to Champ Car. And then I think I was third in points that year. And I didn't get a phone call from anybody.
In those days, were you still able to do Atlantics as almost as a private entrant? Were you taking money to a team? Did you have a sponsor? Because that was one off the step of the big show, even in those days.
Yeah, it was still pretty reasonable back then. We were able to have some sponsorship, and the team had some sponsorship. So it was, I brought some money, and then the team had some money, and it was a modest effort. But the explosion with Atlantics, they started getting associated with the Champ Car teams maybe two or three years after, and you had all the big names owning those lights type teams, and that really drove up the cost. But it was still fairly reasonable back then. But the big thing was where I wasn't able to continue getting that sponsorship, and I had to take a bit of a modest step. So I decided, okay, I was like 26. It was pretty apparent at that point I wasn't going to make it into a Champ Car.
Was that a disappointment at that point? Did you still, coming third against the sort of opposition that you had then in Atlantics was no mean feat with the team that you were with. As you say, you weren't the best funded of teams, weren't the worst either, in fairness, but you clearly had talent. You clearly got your head round open wheel racing pretty quickly, coming out of the Formula Ford 2000 background. Was it a disappointment that you had to sort of say, well, maybe that's not going to be my career path?
I wouldn't say it was a disappointment for saying I wasn't going to make it to Champ Car. It was trying to find your way to climb up a ladder. And that was, Vicki O'Connor owned the Pro Sports 2000 series, and she owned the Atlantic series. So that was a natural progression there. And then from Atlantic, it was obviously into Champ Car. But it was the thing that was disappointing for me was the reality check of, oh man, I love racing, the things I love, sports car racing. I watched every chance I could. At that point, as soon as I got my driver's license, I was in my car. I grew up in the Chicago area and would be up to Road America watching anything. They had the national races there, the June sprints, which were your Formula Fords and Bugeye Sprites and all that stuff, to watch the GP or GTP races back then, with the Lowen Brown 962s and all that, and all those. So I was just a racing fan, and I loved everything. I just wanted to continue racing. So that was the thing of, how am I going to continue to stay involved with the sport? So from then, decided, okay, let's try and take a step back from Atlantics, go to the Formula 2-liter cars, and maybe try and open up our own shop with that. And didn't really go too much as much trying to make a business out of it back then. It was more of, okay, let's take a year and go 2-liter racing. And it's not as sexy, but hey, if we could keep racing, And then, so we tried that and I had some success. There was a rain race at Mid-Ohio and, it was actually able to lap the field and lap second place. So that was a pretty fun one. But other than that, it was, when you look at the numbers of it and a 2-liter shop and the budgets, it became very hard to imagine how you're going to make a business out of this one. And I'm like, this isn't going to work. And, then the next thought was, I got involved, with some people doing some coaching, and the thing that became a progression was they were coaching in sports cars, like doing for our challenge events, and that opened my eyes a bit more into the sports car world. Not so much that I was like, oh, sports car racing, what's that? It was more of, it wasn't what I had known at the time. For sure, I wanted to do it, but then was able to put together some sponsorship to actually do a ride with some of the competition now over the years with a racers group. The first really sports car race I did, I was able to get some money together and rent a ride from Kevin Buckler and rented a seat in the, was it the 1998 12 hour Sebring, and did a couple of races with them. And it was one of those, it wasn't so much of a mission to, you know, keep funding and finding rides out of it. It was more of an exploratory, hey, let's just get in there, see what it is, what it's about, meet some of the people, and that just led my way down the sports car world.
I was going to say, did it almost like a little light go on at that point where you go, oh, hello, there's an opportunity here, the cars are fun, the racing's good, and maybe this is a place I want to be?
Yeah, no, I remember doing Sebring that year, and the cars that have been there and racing against, you only see him on TV and in pictures, and it was just awesome, and being involved with it, you're like, yeah, this is the business here. We have all the manufacturers involved, and that was we were in the GT class, obviously, and you're racing against, you'd seen so many times the Tom Milner run PTG BMWs, and you're out there swapping paint with those guys, and you know Hans Stuck was out there and everything, and it was just really, really cool. And yeah, that was a very big attraction.
And for you, as a lad who'd stood on the bank sides at various races watching some of those names and Bob Wallach, Stuckey racing, that must have been quite a big deal.
Yeah, no, for sure. And even up to my, you know, the last really days that I drove was 2003 and 2004. And, you know, I remember at 2003 when the Bentleys came over to Sebring, and just every time when I was in our Porsche watching the thing come by us, so like every time, even though I was, you know, outright competing, and you're like, wow, that's just so cool, you know. And I remember the first time against the BMW LMR12. Mm-hmm. You know, is that thing, so it's every time you're driving and you just got to take a moment to, you know, just collect your thoughts there. It was so awesome.
So that was how sports cars started for you, and that's obviously how I met you. How did it develop from there, from you going forward as a driver and then moving into the team and the team ownership side of things?
I was very fortunate to hook up with one of the persons I was coaching in the Ferrari Challenge, was Leo Hendry, and yeah, he became fascinated with everything I was doing in the endurance racing, and said, you know, he wanted to do it with me. So we were able to put together. We had a friend that we had mutually met that was trying to start his own team. You know, we committed to run a car with him for the 2000 season that didn't go all that great. But it whetted Leo's appetite enough to say that, you know, this is awesome. It's right when the 996 body styled, you know, water cooled, you know, Porsche GT3R came out, and you know that was a very stable base to build off of. So he, you know, was into it enough where he wanted to start his own team. And it was one of those weird things where our crew chief, we were running, you know, the team, our friend Kurt Bowman was starting, was called Nigmatech, but he basically subcontracted the whole thing to Mike Colucci Racing. And our crew chief on the car was Roger Hawley, who was just a contract worker for Colucci. And so basically Leo and I worked together and put together a team and hired Roger. to basically be the owner of the team, where Leo didn't want to own anything as far as legality, lawsuits, liability, and all that. So he just said, Roger, I'm going to run with you. His commitment was 3 years. We'll set you up. He'll help you get customers. And so, Leo was actually the founding start behind Orbit, which still exists to these days.
And we should say that the payoff on that some years down the line was Leo taking the top step of the podium at Le Mans, somewhere down the line, in fairness, from that. And for those who don't know, Leo Hendry, leading light with the New York Yankees baseball team, a baseball organisation, which is why Peter's explained about the situation with the business side of things. I accept that some of our European listeners might not know that, but if you cast your mind back, you might remember the colour scheme that the car ran in, rather memorable colour scheme. They were good days, weren't they, Peter? They were good days for you and for Leo and for the whole organisation.
Yeah, it was really unique for me because I still had the one foot in the work world. And, aside from all the driving, at the time where I'd met Leo, I was a national sales manager for Oracle Financial Applications. It was a rather respectable position.
And shirt and tie job.
Yeah. And Leo just came from being CEO of TCI Cable, which was purchased by AT&T. And he was without a job and was hired to go be the chairman and CEO of Global Center, which was at the time the number two internet hosting company out in Silicon Valley. Internet hosting by means of like where all the server, not like a dial-up end user, Yahoo and Newsweek and CNN, all those people were the customers, and they had this. So he didn't know much about it, and that was large part of my business, was the business model behind the internet and working with companies. So he hired me to go out there and work for him. We sold that, and in 2001, that's when he sent me to Florida. One of his friends convinced him to buy a boat company, and so I moved from Silicon Valley to Florida to buy a boat company. This all goes somewhere, you just gotta trust me.
I'm really loving this.
And bought the boat company. And I wasn't involved with the financials behind the purchase of the boat company, but after the first week, it was, oh my God, what was purchased here? So it became a year to get rid of the boat company, and that took us to 2002 before we could get out of the boat company. And then I'm like, okay, Leo, I'm in Florida.
Where do I go now?
Yeah, not a lot of business opportunities in Florida. And then he basically said, why don't you go hang out with Roger up at Orbit and help him take it from just a race business into something that's more sustainable as a streetcar shop and help it. So when, Leo knew there was always an exit plan, just a date was the question. But when Leo would leave out of there, he wanted to make sure Roger was in a good position. And the nice thing is, Roger at Orbit still has a great business going on with a lot of streetcar business, and every now and then he's showing back up at Grand Am races and IMSA GT3 Cup races and things. So he's doing good there. But so we were up there for 2 years. There was a bit of a fallout at the end of the 2003 season. Won't go into the private details there about that one, but it was basically the end result was Leo was going to have to go to a different shop. And that was Alvin Springer at Porsche was suggesting a few places to go to, and said, hey, well, you basically own all the stuff. Let's just start up your own company. That's, at the time, it was me, and then the crew chief on the car was Tim Monday. And, we've started up what was called British American Motorsport, and then we referred to it as BAM for the 2004 season. And we did that, and that was going smooth. But that's when I made a big transition from driving. I was signed on to drive with Leo for the full season of 2004. Did Sebring as a driver, and there are so many things going on, and all the business side of it that we had to get going and start up a new company. And it became evident that, holy cow, I can either focus myself to the business or to the driving. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I had done enough driving. It was like 6 years in sports car racing, and for sure I could have gone longer, but it just, I enjoyed the team management side of it. And the only one that was rough was when we went to France in 2004. And you go there as a driver, and you're basically a superhero. It's hard.
Doesn't matter what you're driving, where you are on the grid.
Yeah, everybody knows who you are. You're treated like a demigod, and it's just unbelievable. You go there as a team manager, and you're like, well, I was a driver a year ago, but if it weren't for the twats remembering me, those guys, you lose a lot of that. But once I got past that race, it became good to you go out and you hire the people. You know, we signed on Lucas Luhr and Sasha Mawson to fill my spot for that year, and it was awesome. But
I'm not sure they did as good a job as you could have, Peter. You know, those kids, they didn't have the experience.
But the thing that happened though that year was that Tim was, his side was the technical side, and my side was the finance numbers business side of it. And we had difference of opinions on where the business should be going, that we should grow it. You know, I was big on getting any kind of business in the door for inevitability of Leo retiring. And, hey, I want to be here doing this more than after when Leo retires. And, we had some, heated debate discussions, and it led into one fateful conversation where at the time my mom was diagnosed with cancer, and it was pretty evident that she was in the last kind of 3 months, and I was down in Florida, she was in Chicago. I'm like, you know what, I don't need this, and just checked out, said I'll see you later, offered to still help Leo whatever he needed, but I just retired from that. And then so that was my mom, that was June, and then September is roughly when my mom passed. And then it was okay, a month of getting back to Florida in October, helping my dad with things. And then it became, oh God, now what do I do? I signed off on, my stable employment for the past, 5 years or so. And then it became, the economy was right and enough things with, okay, what do I do now? And it was, all right, let's try this one shot. No partners, no anybody to start my own team up from scratch and go from there. So that's how I got into it.
That's Peter Barron that we're talking with at the moment. Now Starworks Motorsport. It's Tyler's Longmont on RadioLeMond.com. You fairly rattled through the first Le Mans experience, but Le Mans has made a big impact on you, and it began a love affair with that race and that part of France that I detect, and I know you well enough to know that continues to this day. What was it? I mean, other than the demigod status that you were afforded by being a Porsche driver there. But what is it about that place that is so, I mean, you don't have to sell it to me because I know, but I hear this from so many level-headed, sensible people, successful in your business at the time, successful in what you were doing, and yet there is something that is just a complete change of pace when people go to Le Mans.
I've been to, I would say, all the races now. Like when the team that I first started up was Samex, and it, unfortunately we had to close that due to a couple of bad situations. But in the Samex entity, we were actually able to put a car, not compete for a win, but we were able to put a car in the show at the Indy 500, which was, that's one of the all-time shrines of motorsport. And while I was there, it was still an unbelievable experience, but just thinking, France is so much cooler. Yeah, the whole Le Mans thing, it's unbelievable. And it the whole thing, maybe it's just how you're brought up, but I remember as a kid, it was different back then, right? Your parents would go out for the night, and if you're old enough to feed yourself, you're fine by yourself at home. But I remember plenty of times being home at like 10:30 at night, and the Saturday night movie would come on Channel 2, and like twice a year they would play the Steve McQueen Le Mans movie. And I just remember that, like, that was like the world's best movie at the age of like 5 or 6. I remember just vividly watching that, and that and the whole Porsche versus Ferrari battle and the sounds and everything and just seeing it. And you watch it, then to go there in person, and the thing you get, the differences with the 500, people love going to the event, and it's a bit of a party atmosphere where, yeah, there, you know, people like the, back then it was a Danica Patrick and the Hilo Castaneves, and it's, yeah, they like that, but it's almost like an excuse to once a year go watch some cars. And the difference with France is it's, you know, there's so much more national pride that goes on there, and people love their, you know, their manufacturers, whether it was Bentley or the Pescarolos or Peugeot or Audi, and you get the swarms of people. The thing that just blows you away was the, you know, the starting scene in the movie Le Mans where, you know, he pulls into town, and I forget the girl's name in the movie, but she's buying the flowers in that little square. Yeah. And here there's a driver's parade there. And I remember, you know, driver's parades in the United States, you're like, who cares? You know, I'm not going. They're like, no, you got to go. And when you go there and you see it's a couple hundred thousand people there and you can't even walk. It's just unbelievable. And then on the grid, you know, still to this day, you know, one of those things, like on my deathbed, you'll certain thoughts will go through. And one of them is the first time on the grid, where they do all the national anthems, and they blitz through a lot of them quickly. You know, we don't need to hear the whole Denmark, you know, so they go to 30 seconds of that. But then when they get to God Save the Queen, and there's, you know, 100,000 drunken Brits screaming that, and you're like, holy cow, that's unbelievable. And then it's, you know, right after that is, you know, like 200,000 drunken French singing, you know, the French national anthem. Is just, it's unbelievable. You know, You just can't the whole pride and what people pack behind it, and the history and the marks and everything is pretty special.
Now that left its mark on you, clearly, but you guys left your mark on Le Mans with one feature in particular, and the fact that you're laughing means I don't even have to mention it. But the good news is for fans that it's back, and I am talking about
the slingshot.
Yeah, the slingshot.
It was one thing that I was very careful when we were planning out our budgets that with Enzo, I said, you know, there's a line item in this year's budget. I said, last time we went there, we went with 2,000 t-shirts and you know, a $19 high-powered slingshot going, you know, 3 per. So we're going to have to better that this year. But that was...
Where did that come from? Because, I mean, you know, you talk about the... You were talking there about the formality in some respects of that driver introduction coming on the back of the convertible cars, and there were you guys firing these t-shirts into the main grandstand on that famous part of the Le Mans circuit, famous for both triumph and tragedy, of course, from the 1955 disaster. And there were you guys pinging these t-shirts into the crowd, and the place went wild. Well, whose idea was it?
You know, it goes back to my childhood days. I remember seeing, you know, in between turn 5 and 6 at Road America, you know, the short little shoot up the hill there, there were two different groups that had water balloon. They were using the proper intended use water balloons and were pegging each other during the race. I thought, well, that'd be fabulous, but we might get in trouble. So let's, you know, but the whole thing too of to make a lasting mark, and, you know, as little as they know, like all the people there, they make up a group that makes a lasting impression on me or Leo or this year, you know, Enzo. Like I try and tell Enzo, you have no idea what you're getting in for, how cool this is. And you're just not going to believe how, I mean, it's like all those people out there that make it part of it. So if we could give away a couple thousand t-shirts and have some fun doing it, and people remember us and they're like, yeah, that was cool, those guys, then all the better.
I can hear the line forming now for people who want to try and catch them. Let's bring you up to date, not to skip through too much, but to bring up to date, you committed, as you say, to doing something on your own, with only yourself as the man out there. How scary was that to put yourself effectively in the firing line? In the previous iterations, there'd always been a partner or a couple of partners, but you now had the name above the door, kind of thing, as you went forward.
It was real scary for sure. You know, there was our first race. We were able to get 5 real solid racers, you know, not pros, but just good drivers in a Porsche, you know, car at Daytona. And you know, through some good fortunes and guys doing a great job out there, we stumbled into a 3rd place finish on the podium. And, you know, people saw it as a bit of luck, and, you know, you guys, yeah, this and that. Like, okay, we're going to have to back this up because the phones weren't ringing yet. And so after that, the next race was Homestead, and nothing to do. I needed to put people in the car if, you know, it was going to die. And, you know, there was supposed to be a stream of people coming in. Never happened. In 2005, the economy was decent, so it was... you know, hoping that was going to happen, but you know, we went to there's a big Porsche Club event here in Sebring in February, and no traffic resulted as of that. So like, okay, we're going to have to do something, and invested into the Homestead race where we put Brian Sellers and Ryan DL in the car. And long story about Ryan, we could save for another day, but I had been eyeing Ryan, not really knowing it, and through just a strange turn of events, he was able to get into our car for that one. And we had the pole, fastest race lap. We got hit by a Daytona prototype car leading. And so I think after that, people went and saw, okay, maybe Daytona wasn't a fluke. These guys are fast. They know what they're doing. And then the phone started to ring. We had some more success with GT cars. Was able to...
Was there a massive sigh of relief at that point that you'd rolled the dice and the gamble had worked?
Yeah, no, but then it's like you need more. How we keep it going? And there's never that relief. There's maybe relief for like a week, but you know, not like we can sit here and relax. I had to keep working on it. We landed a Daytona prototype customer in May of 2005. You know, did reasonably well with that as a gentleman. Then, let's see, that parlayed into we landed the Sitco program with Milka Christmas Eve of 2005. And we still had programs for 2006, but that was one that started to give us a proper budget and put us on the map. And then it was good. One thing we did do was we went IndyCar racing, and that didn't work out so well. You know, it was really cool to do, and it was nice to have a car on the grid there, but that was the start of the downfall of the company there, that we had to shut the doors. But then, kind of where this is all going is in 2008, where you're faced with, you know, that fear of it was after... the Daytona race where we were still expecting payment and the payment never come, and we were behind, you know, on receivables from some people, and the money wasn't showing up, and it was that fear of we're not going to make the next race. And it was Barber was the first race after Daytona, and it was like, okay, we can't go. And then try to keep it going, and I had a decent watch collection, as most drivers do. He had to sell the watch collection to keep things going. He had to sell everything, sold the car, you name it, sold it to keep it afloat and going. Then you're left with I can't do it. Got it. And then that's as bad as it gets, you know. But then...
And that story is a story that is not unique to you, and I'm not, by any means running you down, but that is private ear motor racing in a lot of cases, outside of the big contracts, outside of, the factory deals. That's going on all over motorsport.
Yeah, no, it's you do one bad deal, one check that doesn't come through, one contract. I had a bulletproof contract with somebody, and person didn't pay me, or a company didn't pay me on something, and it was basically a seven-figure number, and... go to my lawyer, and my bank helped write the document, and everything was, and they're like, yeah, no, that's the document, and had our lawyer contact the company's lawyer, and they're like, yeah, go ahead. And then I talked to my lawyer, and they're like, you know what, your document's perfect, your contracts are perfect, get prepared to spend 4 to 5 years in court over this. I guarantee we'll win it. You're absolutely going to win, but they're going to drag it out, and you're going to have to spend about $500,000 to get this done. At the end of the day, you're going to have to settle between $500,000 and $750,000. And, so what do you want to do? And what can you do? There's nothing you can do. You can learn from it, which is fortunately what we had to take away. But going with that, the thing that I learned was, that's as bad as it can get. The house was... like 3 months in, in late mortgage with the foreclosure companies calling and doing everything to keep it afloat. And at the end of the day, you're like, you know what? That's with everybody healthy, that's as bad as it can get. And then you just stomach through it and, you know, start at it again, you know, and survive and get back on it, which is what's, you know, kind of Star Wars has been about, and making right decisions. And, you know, the thing that I'm very fortunate and lucky is, you know, I look at it and say, okay, I made a couple of bad decisions in my, you know, upper 30s, not in my upper 60s. So, you know, I think what we have going on here is a good thing. You know, a lot of faith and trust in people you have to, you know, keep in check there. And, but, you know, really fortunate to have met Enzo and Alex that have helped transform this and, you know, regain the racing faith. And, but, yeah, I think it's, you know, it's going solid now.
You're listening to Tyler's Long One with Peter Barron, and he's very kindly given us some of his time. Let's explore that, because you talked about the Sitgo thing a little bit earlier on with Milka, of course, and Enzo and Alex, who, by the way, seem to be, every time I turn up with a motor race, particularly an endurance race, they are racing everywhere at the minute. They are getting as much experience as possible, and they are turning a few heads. So, you know, well done with those guys, because clearly they are a formidable team. The economy in Europe, and to a certain extent in North America as well, is not great. So finding guys who can support a program and have the enthusiasm for, as well as the financial thing, is never an easy thing. So how did you meet these two guys? And it's a South American connection again, but how, you know, where do they get their excitement from, and why are they more interested in endurance racing and Star Wars than anywhere else that could, quite honestly, go and spend their money?
Without
giving any trade secrets away, obviously.
No problem. You know, I think I was real lucky where they called up Grand Am. It was basically Enzo called up Grand Am, said he had some funding to do Daytona. Enzo's from about 15-20 minutes away. Yeah, we had a couple open seats for Daytona last year, and Gary Cummings at Grand Am, who's a helpful liaison with people, basically said, hey, you know, go right down the street, see Peter. And, you know, so I met with Enzo, and we did a one-off for Daytona last year. And, you know, the thing that I strongly believe in is karma and being upfront and being truthful with people. And, you know, the nice thing is I came from a finance accounting background. So we did Daytona, and the deal that we structured was, you know, it was basically a cost, you know, plus you're going to pay us this amount to do it. Yeah. You know, he brought his chassis and updated his chassis and everything. And it was, you know, all the accounting was ticked and tied. Everything's perfect. And said, hey, everything's here, all the detail. And Enzo is the type of guy, too, that he's like, hey, I trust you, I believe you. Mm-hmm. And it's a very open, trusting relationship there. And you know, I think our biggest strength is, you know, open communication and, you know, just being honest and straightforward. You hear so many of the horror stories out there, and I don't want to throw any other teams under the bus, but you see some of the stuff that happens, and you just can't believe that there might be a super rich guy. Now, Enzo's, you know, he's financially secure and established, but you know, he does bring legit sponsorship to a program. He's not of the Scott Tucker realm or anything like that, where, you know, he does bring, you know, sponsorship to it. So, you know, he's mindful about it, but you hear of all these rich guys out there just forking out money, and it's just nauseating watching it. And I look after all these guys' money and programs as if it or my own, and treat them with respect. And, you know, it's much better to, in baseball over here, you know, hit a single every time versus trying to hit a home run or, you know, the one bull wants to run down the hill so we'll just walk in.
Okay, absolutely. We know that one as well. I mean, that it is frustrating for everybody in motorsport, because in some respects, those bad pennies, and by no means are there an awful lot of them, but it doesn't need to be a lot of them, because it spoils it for everybody else, all the good guys. And there are a lot of good guys out there, like yourselves, the private teams, who are the backbone, particularly of endurance racing. I mean, you've chosen a well-trodden path, but it doesn't make it any easier. So Daytona Prototypes Continental Challenge with the Mustangs, that's been brought on board. Again, solid business reasons for that. A series that's on its up at the moment with a huge entry list and manufacturer interest and cost-effective racing for the people who want to go racing.
The thing where it's so hard is, like I mentioned before, basically coming from financial ruins to get involved and even contemplate owning a race car. And that's one of the things that the Grand Am series does that is so outstanding, where basically, if you wanted to go out and be a Daytona prototype team right now, you could pick up a chassis, a generation one or two chassis, for maybe $100,000-$150,000, depending on condition. An update kit from Riley is right around $180,000, but you're going to be into it for $330,000, $280,000, somewhere in that ballpark, and you could go out and effectively compete for wins. Mm-hmm. I read all the gossip pages and columns, and somebody was out there posting on one saying that, complaining that he doesn't like Grand Am because essentially all you need to do is show up with money and you could buy a win. And it's like, okay, that's true in every series, and there's a little bit of that maybe misconception with Grand Am, but you're racing against Ganassi. They have their own win tunnel, right?
They have their own mountain with a hole through it. Yeah, that they use as a wind tunnel.
and it's still glorified spec racing, where a lot of stuff is you can't change it, but it's still about people and drivers, and it's not just writing a check. It's no different than Audi or Peugeot or whatever. Theirs is just has a couple more zeros on it.
Who spends the most in Formula One? That would be Red Bull. And how many titles have they won recently? Yes, that would be money well spent.
But it's the whole thing of, as a team, you could go out there with a tool, and I was with the Citgo program, was able to go out and buy my own chassis and invest in it, knowing that, okay, we're going to do Citgo this year and hopefully renew it for next year. And it's, the components of it and the inventory and the suspension and, the uprights are still the same as they made in 2005, and that's something as a privateer owner you could grasp, where we're still putting our heads around the LMP2 numbers, and there's a homologated car this year. You can buy last year's car and Molly, but there's the WEC is starting with their rules to put some caps around it. But that was so scary when you looked at the cars in the that 2000 through 2010 era, where every year Lola was coming out with a new car or a new update, and then Reynard would do a car, and then there was like the car of the week, and that was something that you just couldn't sink your teeth into. But now with the cost cap and LMP2, now it starts to make sense, where okay, at the end of the season you should still have a car that you could use for the next season, albeit with maybe an upgrade kit.
Well, you'll hear Peter's thoughts on WEC and P2 in another interview on RadioLeMans.com. If you search around the archive, you'll find that in one of our midweek motorsports from Sebring. And also, don't forget that he has very kindly as well during this first showed us around the factory unit here at Starworks. So you'll hear a little more about it in there if you search through the archives. I suppose the $64 million question for you is, do you miss the driving? And even with all the success that you've had recently as a team owner, and would you contemplate going back to it? I mean, recently we saw Hurley Hayward do his 40th out of 50 Daytona 24s. Wayne Taylor keeps retiring and coming back out of retirement every time I speak to him. I don't know. Do you miss it? Do you miss the cut and thrust of getting into that car and the undoubted adrenaline burst of getting into a car and going out driving, particularly when you've got all the toys on your doorstep?
Yeah. The only thing I miss more than driving is winning. It sounds kind of like a bad cliche or something, but I knew my abilities of a driver, and I was I knew that, albeit I thought I was relatively decent and had some good success, but there's always that person that's a little bit better. So I would rather see, you know, a Ryan and a Lucas in our cars, and we got a nice announcement coming out shortly about our third driver in the WEC, and they're better than me.
So, what is it not? It must, come on, Peter. As we're sitting here now, on a test day, when you're out there, right, is it not tempting to just go and grab a set of overalls and a helmet and a hands device and buckle yourself in? And you can't tell me that you're not going to sit in the WEC car and at least take a couple of laps in it.
Well, there's two different things there. So going out and enjoying the car, for sure. You know, like I had Enzo, and we've had some chats where, you know, with the Continental stuff, we've joked about, all right, I'm going to have to get out there and kick your guys' asses at, like, Road America and stuff. And it'd be fun, but that, mainly to compete with friends and things like that on the social. The hardcore making a career out of it and devoting your life and the fitness and all the mental stuff and the, you know, as much as you see these guys on track driving and you think they're fitting everything, they're working 10 times as hard off track on the politics behind it, trying to line up the next ride. You know, you see right now, I'm friends with a lot of Porsche and Audi drivers over the years, and you see that Porsche is coming in with 2014 with their P car, and you see all these guys starting to worry and jockey for position and trying to line up things. And like that might answer a question, why did you see Mike Rockenfeller in a Porsche GT car at Daytona this year versus he had a ride with us that he,
so you don't miss any of that side of it.
Oh no, and it's like, I don't want to deal with the politics. I want to win. You know, it was, we got from scratch to 2 years, we got our first win at Starworks at Mid-Ohio last year. That's way more fun than finishing fourth or fifth, you know?
So. But you still didn't answer the question. Are you going to sit in the WEC car and give it a couple of laps somewhere when you're shaking it?
No, absolutely. If Enzo, you know, it's his car, and he said he's going to let me. And if we're at a place that, you know, it's proper time to, for sure, you can't pass it up. I mean, nobody in their right mind would ever pass that up. Yeah, you know, like driving a Mustang Continental car at a test day at like a rainy Snetterton or something like that. You know, I don't need to do that. But WC car, if we're testing at MagniCore or something like that, oh, you know where you're going to find me. I just got to make sure I could get these breeding hips in the car.
Peter, thanks for your time. Good luck for the future.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
This program is a Radio Show Limited production. For more, go to www.radiolemon.com. Radio Show Limited. We talk to the world.